I advise people to say, will you regret not trying this next job? If you work hard and have done a good job, you can typically go back to your old job or employer. You can always go backwards, but the only way to go forward is to leap.
The new school. This is The New School with your host, Christine Hong. Welcome to a new kind of school, where we talk about career paths you don't normally get to hear about in the classroom. Every episode, I talk to someone with an interesting life path and learn about how they got to where they are today. Hey guys, happy Monday. I'm your host, Christine Hong, and I've got an amazing guest for you today. I'm so honored she agreed to be on our show. Blair Shane has been the CMO of Sequoia Capital, one of the top venture capital firms, Stanford Business School, and Cal Academy of Science. I've always wondered what it's like to be on top of the career ladder, a C-suite exec at a large successful company. And today, she explains what that's like. In this episode, Blair goes over what she thinks makes a good marketer, her path to becoming a CMO, and gives advice on how to grow brands. Before we start, I just want to drop a note that this interview was recorded before the outbreak of COVID-19 in the US and does reflect pre-quarantine conditions.
Blair, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time today.
It's an honor. I think that this podcast and the theme will be so helpful to so many people.
I guess I'm interested in how you even got into marketing as a career. What about it appealed to you when you started?
You know, it's a really good question. And to be honest, I was just drawn to running and growing businesses. My first marketing job after graduate school was in packaged goods. I was actually trained at General Mills. That's the place that does all of the kids' cereals. So I was first put on the team running Total Cereal. And then I moved to developing Yoplait yogurt new products. And then I actually helped start our vending and convenience store business. So things like Chex Mix and Bugles and fruit snacks. And marketing at General Mills was defined as running a $50 million business or brand like Total. And so my core responsibilities included everything from advertising to packaging to product development, even nutrition, and then forecasting and pricing. And so given that start, I think of marketing as go-to-market, not just with, I think a lot of people think of as just branding or PR or even demand gen in the Valley.
How did you end up at General Mills? Were you just looking for a marketing position at the time?
You know, it's a really good question. I was looking to run a business. So when I was at Stanford Business School, I thought about leaving to start my own business. I interviewed there before I graduated. And what I loved about it is you had the ability to run a business with the safety net of a big company. It literally just happened that at General Mills, running a business was quintessential marketing. That's how I ended up doing marketing.
Oh, okay. And that became your focus.
It did, exactly.
Why did you leave General Mills? How did you decide what to do next?
That's a really good question. So my husband and I went to different graduate schools. And so we ended up in Minneapolis, which is what General Mills is. He's also from the East Coast and I'm from the West Coast. And we wanted to start our lives together in kind of a neutral place. But after about 3 years, Rick, who is an investment banker, he was working at a company called Piper Jaffray, got a great opportunity to do banking and research in San Francisco. And my family is from San Francisco. And Rick's family is from Hartford, Connecticut. And to tell you the truth, there's just a lot more opportunity in the Bay Area for a dual career couple. And we knew that at some point we wanted to have kids and it would be really nice if we were both working to have family nearby to help out.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Why did you decide to stay in marketing instead of doing your own business at the time?
Oh, I have to admit, I was just risk averse. I actually regret, it's the one thing in my business career that I regret not training before I had kids, was starting my own business. I just decided to stay because after running those brands, I got so much great opportunity. So when I came back to the Valley, I was able to get great, very big marketing jobs at a couple of startups. And then from there, I was able to get a great job at Charles Schwab. So it just fed on each other. And I think maybe, you know, at the point where I wanted to become a mom, being a co-founder and a new mom at the same time is just a heavy lift.
What do you think makes a good marketer?
So at the end of the day, marketing is about go-to-market. It's about how you acquire customers and then build loyalty. So a few things can really help make you a good marketer. I think the first and most important thing is understanding the customer. It sounds so basic, but market research and really honing into that customer pain point is the first thing that every great marketer should understand. The second thing is building a product that meets that customer pain and then believe in it with all your soul. Go to the ends of the earth to improve your product. So listening and empathy skills, and then have a balance of creative and analytical skills to both improve that product for organic growth. And then when you market, meaning you promote or you share messaging to try to attract new customers, it's important that you both try novel methods. That's the creative skill. But then you also analyze the results so that you can hone that strategy and put more dollars towards the things that are working. And the last thing I'll say for any role is just being a really good manager and leader. So at the end of the day, marketing, like almost every other business function, is about leading teams and helping to set direction, and then recruiting and hiring the best people are also critical skills.
Yeah. Do you find the work or skills needed differ for different types of businesses, or is it pretty similar?
I think it does differ. Some people believe that you use the same playbook over and over again. I believe the best marketers are passionate about connecting the product or service with their target audience. And every product and service and every target audience is different. So I believe that that playbook should vary. You know, there's a few skills that span both B2B and B2C, like brand and positioning and PR, but the weight of the other things should vary. So for B2B, typically it requires better content marketing and analyst relations skills or things like account-based marketing. Where if you're running a consumer business or product, you're going to heavy up on brand and social. The list of the levers is, I would probably say, 70% the same. But depending on where you are in the stage of your business and what your audience is, you may play them up or down.
I'm actually kind of curious. So based on these things you look for in a good marketer, do you have certain interview questions you prefer?
You know, it's so funny. I actually did an article about this for Sequoia. So I always like to ask someone how they failed and what they did about it. Or, you know, what's your development area? What's your biggest weakness? Mostly because everybody's human and has a strength. I think the other thing is, what do you want to do in 5 or 10 years? And seeing how people answer that, I think, is really compelling as well, just to see if what the job you're offering is aligned in some way to helping them achieve their dream. I always ask the question of, what do you need from a manager to help make you successful? What do you look for? And then I just ask them to describe something they're most proud of and why.
Yeah, those are really good questions. Was there any answers that ever stood out to you?
The best interviewees are those who are willing to share with the person hiring them what they most want in the world, what could help them get there, and maybe what they're afraid of. Because we spend 80% of our days at the office with our coworkers and trying to achieve really big, meaningful work. And so getting to that level is pretty important if you choose to have a lean team of stars all working together to achieve a common goal.
What was the path to CMO like? Did you always think you would become a chief exec one day?
You know, no, I never really, if people ask me what I would want to do in my life, it's still the same three things. It's to be a CEO, to be a teacher, or actually to be a peace negotiator. So CMO is not anywhere there, but CMO is a way to achieve actually all three of those things. So in many of my roles, it involved a significant amount of influence management, both with the people that I worked with and the various targeted audiences that I was trying to approach. You're always teaching as a manager, or the best managers teach. And like I said, my approach to marketing is the more traditional product, price, promotion, and placement ones. It's just how you run a business. But in general, I followed my passion. And my husband gave me some of the best work advice about, you know, my career probably about 15 years ago. And he was saying, you're going to regret not trying. And so basically now I advise people to say, will you regret not trying this next job? If you work hard and have done a good job, you can typically go back to your old job or employer, right?
Yeah.
Rarely will they not hire you. And so just never regret not trying, because typically, if you've done a good job, you can always go backwards. But the only way to go forward is to leap.
I was wondering if to jump to chief exec, does it feel any different than a normal promotion?
It didn't, because I think I've always been driven to kind of change the world and make it better. I mean, even my essays to business school were actually about reforming the Department of Education. I just thought I'd always work my way up for a for-profit company and then lateral over. I just tried to do the best job that I could. I mean, I think as you progress in your career, you should always listen more. It sounds kind of counterintuitive, but listen more, coach more, tell people less what to do, and really inspire greatness within your team. I think those are the biggest things. And I think the other things that really matters as a chief exec is helping your team set a clear vision and then focus to achieve it.
Cool. Next, I'd kind of like to dive into like the particular brands you've built from scratch or rebooted. Mm-hmm. How did you figure out the strategy for these brands?
So it's interesting. In the last 15 years or so of my career, I've spent my time helping great brands not rest on their laurels and to modernize them. So somehow I've been identified as a change agent who could help move the California Academy of Sciences, which is like the Museum of Natural History in San Francisco, or Stanford, or even Sequoia, push forward. So the number one thing to do in those roles is to really understand what is essential to the culture, to the brand, to the business that you must hold on to for dear life and protect it. The second thing is to figure out what you need to cut off, what is no longer serving the business or brand well, and really be clear about what those things are and literally cut it off like you would appendage. And then the third part of that is being super creative and brainstorm what you need to do to modernize the brand and then add that to it. So it's really a three-pronged process of holding on for dear life to what matters, letting go of what doesn't serve you, and then make the leap to try some new things to modernize the brand. Early in my career, when I worked on new products like Yoplait yogurt key lime pie flavor or the fruit snacks variation, it was more of traditional identifying customer needs, building the product, and then building advertising and marketing to support it. And in each case, it's different each and every time. Like I said earlier on, there's not one playbook.
Yeah, that's what I figured. I'm actually really curious about when you joined Cal Academy of Science.
Yeah.
How did you decide what to do when you joined?
So I joined about 14 months before the relaunch, and we didn't have anything in place. And so a lot had to do with building the basics of the brand and the wayfinding and the pricing and things of that nature. And then the number one kind of innovative thing that we did is a lot of people said, oh, people will just come. And I took the approach of saying, no, the first moment, the first day, the first year of this new museum needs to signal that it's new and also need to signal that there's more demand than supply, because then that will create a halo so that people will want to come to the museum for several years after the opening. So I think the biggest innovation was looking at the opening like a true commercial product launch, and that served the museum really well. It was hard to manage the crowds, but it definitely helped drive membership and utilization of the museum for a very long time, which was great. We held on to things like the penguins or the Steinhardt Aquarium, but we also really reinforced new features like the rainforest, or instead of doing fixed pricing, we did variable pricing for the first time for a museum, and created things like Nightlife, which was the program for people 21 to 30 who typically aren't a museum's target, but it was able to cultivate the next generation of museum goers.
Yeah, I really want to talk to you about Nightlife, actually. How did you think of it or design it?
It was really a business metric. Most of the Academy's business was from membership, which was typically parents with kids, and that's great and all, but you really need to cultivate those people well before they're parents with children. And so also Nightlife was a way to leverage the museum's footprint and capital in the evening, which typically wasn't used. And so we just created a model and a product offering that would attract people to come with their friends every Thursday night. And the nice thing is that now that's been in place for, wow, over 10 years. Now, all of those folks at that age are now parents with kids and so now are coming. So it's a nice full life cycle that the museum now offers.
Yeah, I'm honestly so impressed by that, because I remember interning in San Francisco in 2014 and it was like the ultimate date spot, honestly.
Oh, good.
It was just like not something I would have ever thought of to go. And people were like, oh, check them in Nightlife, then you'll seem like kind of like sophisticated. Plus it's 21 plus and there's alcohol.
The brand that we worked on there, we were combining the words hip and intellect. There weren't really anything in the city where if you were kind of a dork like me, you could go and have fun. We called it this hip intellect and it worked, which is nice.
Yeah, most of my friends were 20 at the time. So we were like literally talking about using fake IDs to get into Nightlife. That didn't work though. But
good.
Yeah. Anyways, how did you approach when you join Stanford Business School when you're a CMO? What was your strategy there? I'm curious.
You know, it's really not that different. So Stanford's brand as a business school is to change lives, change organizations, change the world. And what we were doing things that's actually pretty modern and novel for a business school, but the manifestation of it was sometimes old and kind of fuddy-duddy. So we updated the brand, and actually we had the opportunity to launch. Phil Knight had given money to launch the new buildings called the Knight Management Center. And much like the Academy, we used that opening launch to also launch the brand. And in doing so, that actually became the trigger to do things like update the alumni magazine and launch new entrepreneurial offerings in other markets.
How do you decide how to split the budget or what to focus on? Like, what will make the most impact?
You know, I would say in every great marketing strategy, you have to be able to really measure, are you getting new customers? I think that's the first thing. So how do you measure your customer acquisition? And before that, it's how do you measure your awareness? And so certainly having a keen understanding of what your base awareness metric is and then how it's evolving. I think secondly, how do you acquire new customers? But then thirdly, is there churn in your customer base? In your experience, your product experience, your service experience, are you able to keep them? And then I think from then, it's how do you drive loyalty? So you may have heard of things like Net Promoter Score, because in general, you want to leverage your customer base to drive new customers, to refer them. And I think the last two things that I would look at are some kind of reputation management, because that will be your baseline awareness in between product news. And the last thing that people rarely think of is, do people want to come work for you? A lot of companies don't think of marketing to their employees or marketing to prospective employees. In the world of technology, the number one competitive advantage is the people who work for you, and it also helps lead to speed to market. And so if you don't have a strong employer brand, it ends up being very hard to have a strong customer brand.
Yeah, that makes sense, because you want to feature your employees in the PR.
Right. I mean, there's so much competition for talent. You need to find a way to distinctively attract talent who want to help build your business, or they'll just go somewhere else.
Well, I guess for Cal Academy of Science, you can see initiatives bring in people buying tickets. I imagine for Stanford Business School, you can see if an initiative gets more people to apply to business school there.
Yeah.
How did you measure success for Sequoia Capital?
So at Sequoia, we probably only make about 30 investments a year. But at the end of the day, we don't want to miss looking at a single founder or new company. And so the key there was twofold. I think first, at least for me, my focus was on our existing founders. How do I make them and their companies most successful? And the reason for that is they're the best referral source. So that's an example where taking care of your customers is so important, because at the end of the day, you know from the work you do, if you're going to look for funding for your new business, who are you going to ask for their advice? Fellow founders. So I really focused on products and programming that would help our founders and their companies succeed. And in doing so, that would lead to new business for us. I think the second thing is making sure to modernize the brand and the messaging of Sequoia so that we would get a chance to look at every new company. I feel like I would fail if there was a great new company where our investors didn't get a chance to talk to the founders. So making us feel approachable and also helpful to really early stage founders, because Sequoia prides itself of always being in what we call the pre-seed and seed business, and then working with those super early companies all the way through IPO and beyond. So we measured it on the number of seed stage companies that wanted to talk to us even before they maybe even needed funding.
How did you achieve goal one of making sure the existing founders were supported?
I mean, it was in actually in two very different ways. One is in what I would call bespoke help. How could me or the investors help them and their companies with individual problem solving or growth opportunities? So that could be helping them with a launch, helping them in a crisis situation, helping them hire. That was first, and that's obviously very specialized to each founder and company. And then the other way was how my team helped them was in much more scalable ways that had to do with connecting founders with founders and building community. And there's a few ways Sequoia has done that. One is through events. So we have an event called Basecamp where we take all of our founders camping. Well, it really gives founders an opportunity to reflect and connect with each other. And certainly we bring in great speakers and deliver great content. And then from there, we started what I would call founder boot camps, a program called AMP, which stands for Amplify, Mobilize, and Propel. It's like a 10-week intensive where founders of really young companies that seed and Series A companies come together, and they meet every Thursday for 4 hours in the evening going through critical business building concept, and then they get to connect with each other. Because at the end of the day, most founders have the skills they need. They just need the support of a great network to help them solve problems in the moment. So those were a couple ways that we built loyalty, either very specific or in building community.
Interesting. Is that how you try to stand out from other brands?
Those are two ways that we really do try to stand out. I think the other way is just we have a very small dedicated team that's all in. We think of ourselves as a partner versus an investor, and we'll stand by you through each stage of the journey. And we also have expertise at each stage of the journey, as it really does vary depending on where you're at.
For goal two, you're saying you want to make sure no companies that were awesome, like, didn't apply to Sequoia. You're like one of the top VC companies. Do you actually have trouble with that?
I would say we have trouble in that people may not want to come meet with us before they feel like they're ready, because they really, in many cases, may want to work with us, but they feel like they want to be perfect. And that, in fact, is the worst thing, because we can actually be most helpful when companies are still rough around the edges. And I don't think it had anything to do with us besides the fact that a founder sees brands like Airbnb or Dropbox or Google, and they think, oh, I'm not them yet. But those companies were, you know, two or three people in our offices when they first started. So I think it's telling those stories that it's never too soon to start with a Sequoia, and then also being helpful to them even prior to going into business with those companies.
Yeah, that makes sense. I don't think I would even think of talking to Sequoia unless I had at least a million users or something.
And that's detrimental to our business too, because we don't want you to wait that long, because we can probably help you get to those first million users.
So when's a good time to apply? What stage?
I think obviously it depends. You don't have to have product market fit yet. You have to have a compelling market size and a great team and ambition. And so that's all important. But know that we can help with product market fit, and know that we can help with that early scaling.
Well, my podcast is a very new brand. So,
do
you need any marketing advice for me?
That's such a good question. I think the first thing that I was noticing is get all your guests to promote their episodes. I think that that's a really important thing, because if you think of the podcast world, there's so many, right? It's competing. And so I would make a specific ask of your guests to share it with the people who would find the new school valuable. And then I think the last thing is I would just get on the lists. So when I Googled best podcasts for career development or college students or up-and-comers, so I would identify the managers of some of those lists and get on them, and then just make sure that you're not shy about asking those of us who want you to be successful to sing your praises.
That is such a great idea.
I would just make sure that people know you exist and that they're advocating for you.
Back to being CMO, you've been CMO of three companies now. More curious what the day-to-day is like.
You know, what I love about marketing is every day is so different. And the variedness of it is the thing that makes it so fun. At Sequoia, it could have been the beginning of the day. I could be working with founders at our boot camp. I could be advising them on go-to-market, or I could be working with Sequoia Limited Partner or a member of my team helping them with their career. So no day was the same. But I think every day tied to our business goals, whether it was attracting the next generation of founders, helping them be most successful, serving our limited partners, or growing our employees. So I think every executive should take a look at how they're spending their time, and it should somehow be tied to the primary business objectives.
I think about, especially with something like marketing, it's pretty subjective and unpredictable on what will work sometimes. So how do you evaluate what you want to go with?
Yeah, and I think you're reinforcing that marketing planning, you have to approach in a disciplined way. And if you do, it makes these choices pretty easy and it works the majority of the time. I think the key is, one, to be clear on what your business objectives are. Two, to focus on a few things that matter. And then three, making sure that at least, this is going to sound counterintuitive, that 20% of your plan initiatives and dollars are net new ideas, which means that you actually have to cut 20% out of the existing, because you can't make it 120. So 80% can be things that are tried and true that are working. But 20 to 30% have to be net new ideas. And then you can measure each one of them. I think people fail when they have too many objectives and doing too many things.
I love that when I read that. I forgot which article, but you're saying every year you ask your team to eliminate 20% of their budget and project. Yep. Did you come up with that on your own or where did that come from?
You know, I don't know where I came up with that. I must have learned it from a mentor along the way. I think, you know, it may have been in my days at Charles Schwab. We had to do some cost cutting and there was just a forced cost cutting of 20% or 30%. And I think I carried that forward to the good years where it wasn't forced. And I thought, oh, this would be a really good exercise to just trim even things that are working well, but they're not working as well as the other things to make room for new ideas. Otherwise, you're just piling new ideas on top of old ones and people don't have infinite bandwidth. Yeah. So I think it probably came from just pure cost cutting and I figured out a way to turn it into creating new ideas.
Could you kind of walk me through example of a business goal and then the 80% you kept maybe that was working, the 20% you added that was new?
The immediate one that comes to mind is the Academy went from fixed pricing to variable pricing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a little bit less of what you're asking for, but I think it was a big monumental mind shift for a museum to go to variable pricing based on, you know, just changing prices. That's maybe more a scary one versus the 80-20.
Was the goal increase revenue?
The goal was to increase revenue and to make sure we were capturing the right price at the right time for the customer versus having the set price for all the same people on the same day and time at the museum. It makes sense, right? It's the reason why, you know, ticket pricing works so well or you have different prices for movies at different times. I mean, I loved our plans in every organization that I met, but you just aren't pushing your organization forward if you don't allow the team to dream on what could be better.
I was wondering what it's like managing a team like that because you have all these people throwing these new ideas at you and how do you even pick which creative strategy to go with? Is it instinct? And how do you make the people who are like kind of rejected feel better?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's two different questions in terms of like how you manage the entire team. That's an easier question. From a creative strategy standpoint, it always has to start with your business objective. Does it tie to it? And then is the message relevant? But even more than relevant, is it compelling? And then the last thing is it different? Is it differentiated? And I learned these three things a while back from, there's a really good firm called Astrian Partners that works in the consumer space. But the different one is really important. When you evaluate a creative strategy, again, does it tie to the business objective and is it relevant, compelling, and then different? And then to answer your question about what's a strategy for managing an entire team, I would say the first thing is you have to spend time on hiring well. Recruiting and hiring takes time. The second thing is having really clear roles and responsibilities so that people can drive for impact without stepping on each other. And the last thing is just providing clear direction, but then that coaching piece versus micromanaging is also super important.
Okay, yeah, very separate roles. Yeah, I've been there where the roles were not defined clearly enough and obviously naturally you just want to do both if it's right. Not defined for you.
Exactly. Anybody who's ambitious and hardworking, but it's not always the best thing for the team.
Yeah.
Or it's never the best thing for the team if there aren't clear roles and responsibilities established.
Do you have any particular advice for others who want to become a CMO one day?
Well, just in general, even if you don't want to be a CMO, but even founding your own business, just don't ever regret not trying. That's the first one. You can tell that's a core precept. The second thing related to becoming a CMO, have fun with it. You know, flex your creativity and your analytical skills. You can do both. And then the third thing is do your homework and be disciplined. I think that is important because a chief marketing officer is meant to drive revenue. And so that disciplined approach is really important. And the last thing I would say is make sure it's what you want. And how do you do that? By inviting a few people like me to coffee. And I would say that's with any job that you do, especially for the New School podcast. I would say the number one thing for your listeners is no one also should ever regret inviting someone with a job that they may want someday out for coffee.
What's next for you now that you just left Sequoia?
Yeah, you know, that is a very, very good question. In general, I want a big job that makes a difference. So probably a big operator job. I don't know exactly what yet, but it'll somehow be tied to being a CEO, being a teacher, being a peace negotiator, but a big job making a difference.
What's the most difficult decision you had to make to fulfill your destiny?
Oh, probably delaying being with Rick, my husband, for 2 years. So we decided to go to business school apart, and that wasn't the original plan, but it worked out in the end.
Oh, so then you both had a chance to go to business school. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't end up going where he was because I decided to go to Stanford. That was a really, really hard choice, but I was really young and didn't feel like, as much as I loved Rick, I could just move for him at 24. So it was a hard decision, but we figured it out. And he believes in me a ton, and I believe in him, and we're a good team. So it all worked out.
Did you find business school helpful to find your next
job? You know, for me, I did because I was a history major. Mm-hmm. And I had worked in finance after undergrad, and I also kind of fueled my entrepreneurial spirit by starting a nonprofit. But business school did a couple things for me. It gave me all the base skills that I didn't have, you know, the operations, the financial analysis, even the marketing skills, but also opened my eyes to so many other career possibilities, much like your podcast does for folks. So it was definitely worth it for me.
Is there a biggest mistake you feel like you've made in your career?
And you would think I would learn from my mistakes, but I've made it a couple of times. It may sound general, but I'm sure many of you can relate to it, which is my biggest mistake is taking too much accountability for an interpersonal dynamic at work and then not being political enough to fix it, if that makes sense. So my number one advice for folks who are in a political situation is similar to the clear roles and responsibilities, certainly be self-aware and be accountable for your piece of it, but also be mindful of the other dynamics at play.
So do you wish you were less involved or more involved?
I think I wish that I realized that it was not mine to solve, that in difficult work dynamics, it requires all the people involved to be accountable and to help solve. And sometimes that's just tough.
Yeah, it's harder if they both report to you.
Yeah, or, you know, if peers aren't working out. You know, many of us who are solvers, problem solvers, when you face an interpersonal situation that is a struggle to resolve, sometimes we feel like we can work harder to solve it, but sometimes working harder isn't the answer. So what I've learned from that is to step back and be creative about how to either work around it or to invite others in to help jointly solve it versus taking it on yourself.
What do you think is the best thing you did for your career?
Oh, number one thing, which is sometimes hard for all of us, is just being myself. Anytime I was able to be myself and come to work as my full self, I totally thrived. Sometimes that's hard. So be yourself, that would be my first thing. And I think the second thing is taking risks to do what's right for the business or for me versus what the market or friends like thought I should do. So taking those smart risks that I just knew in my core were the right thing to do for the business. And probably I was thinking about this in preparation. Mm-hmm. My first job was at a place called Swan Oyster Depot. I don't know if you've ever been to it. It's in San Francisco.
No.
And it's a very old-fashioned fish market. It's literally one marble counter and you go in and you get the best crack crab and shuck oysters. And you can also get fresh fish to take home and cook for dinner. And I started working there when I was 14 because I was trying to save money to buy a car. And that actually is probably the best thing I ever did for my career because it taught me, I mean, everybody sits at that counter from, you know, a garbage man to the richest people in San Francisco. And so it taught me to treat everybody as equals. It taught me that high quality product comes first, just the power of working a really hard day. So yeah, I'm very grateful for that first job.
Awesome. I guess we're at the end. So I was wondering if there's anything you want to self-pitch?
Okay. So I have a few things. So the first one is I have a good friend named Diana Kapp who just wrote a book called Girls Who Run the World.
Okay.
And it's these great stories, this female CEO journeys, and it's a kid's book. So my first thing is go out and buy Girls Who Run the World for every third through eighth grade girl you know, because it'll completely inspire them. Nice. The second one is pay it forward no matter how junior you are in your career. Pay it forward to a new colleague, go volunteer. So just pay it forward. And then my last one, which is so pertinent today, is get out and vote. Don't leave our democracy up to anyone else. So go out and vote.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed our interview with the amazing Wise Blair Shane. I personally think she gave some of the best people management advice I've heard from anyone, and it's definitely tips I'll be taking for later down the road. Also, personally, I just find her voice very soothing. Stick around to the end to hear a sneak peek of next week's episode. You can find more information about Blair Shane on our website, thenewschoolpodcast.com. To stay up to date on content, make sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at The New School Podcast. Please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you guys get your podcasts. It would be really appreciated. If you do, you could find your review on a future The New School episode. If you or anyone else you know think you have an amazing guest that would be on our show, definitely let us know. Contact us and reach out on our website, thenewschoolpodcast.com.
The New School of Christine Hong is produced by Shristi Biani, Jenny Snyder, and Kiefer Negri. Editing by Sydney Salk, John Simpson, and Joseph Cho. Video editing by Josh Stanley. Special thanks to our marketing team who helps us spread our mission and get the New School name out there. So special shout out to Katie Osaki, Emma Borgerding, Giovanni Cortez, Cynthia Shao, Dina Che, and Marissa Wolfsheimer.
Next week, look out for an interview with one of the men who started Gen Z Kitchen, which has been dubbed by Vogue as the sweet green of Chinese food. Lucas Sin, who was featured on Forbes 30 Under 30 last year, is Gen Z's head culinary director and chef and designs their entire menu.
I remember just going back to bed and thinking to myself, I may or may not have been offered a job. I'm like not really sure. And 3 months later, the first restaurant is open and I'm cooking there.
Come back next Monday to hear how Lucas got started in food, how he has started multiple restaurants, and look at a snapshot of what the day-to-day is like as a culinary director. All right, have a great day, guys. Try something new today.